The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
And welcome to the Green Front, a very exciting edition for me anyway, because I am live in the Progressive Radio Network studios in Manhattan. Boy, this feels like the good old days for me. I used to be on traditional terrestrial radio, boring radio, I guess. It was CBS Network News in the late 80s. I was an overnight anchor. And so coming here in a real studio was really exciting for me, doing this program from my home, usually in the San Francisco Bay Area. This is a nice real radio kind of feeling. It reminds me of my old days. And I was a news reporter and anchor for CBS for many years. Who, those of you who don't know, that's my background. And about 13 years ago, decided that the biggest story of our time, what's happening to our environment, was not getting told. And that's when I started on the trash beat, started out with Trash Talk Minutes in 1997 and worked up to an hour-long program. And that was called Eco Talk on the Air America Radio Network. And nice to be on internet radio, since apparently that's where it's all happening. And really nice to be here in the studio. But even more than that, I'm really thrilled because Steve Barnett, who you probably just heard on Paradise Parking Lot, I've heard the tail end of his show a few times, and he's always talking about my favorite subject, which is our environment. And I've wanted to listen to his show, but time has not permitted that yet. So here he is, and I grabbed him, snagged him as he was on the way out after his show, and said, could we come in and chat for a few minutes about what's going on with our environment, with this oil kill, with climate change? Yeah. And I just came in from New York, from Nashville, spent 3 days with Al Gore for the third edition of his climate training program. I'm one of the 7,000 volunteers who have been trained in the Climate Project program on how to educate people, how to understand the science of climate change. But I tell you, half the conversations were about the politics of climate change. And since I left Nashville on Monday and since I'm here on Wednesday, there was a meeting between President Obama and both Democrats and Republicans who have been at an impasse on critically important climate change legislation. And I was reading the New York Times on the way over here, dismayed to see that absolutely no progress was made. And members of both parties were saying, you know, they were expecting the president, or it was probably a Democrat in favor of strong legislation, was saying, we were waiting for the president to say, this is what we've got to do, this is what you're going to do. And he just didn't take that leadership role. He was like hearing both sides, and, you know, they're supposed to take some action before the August recess, but here it is almost July. It's not looking real likely. So that was a long introduction and way to say thanks for joining me, Steve.
Glad to do it. And in fact, it's interesting to me that President Obama, he's a conciliator. He really, and there's a difference between being a leader and a conciliator. And we have yet, certainly on environmental matters, to see him step up into a leadership position.
Especially from that Oval Office speech. He started to say we need to make the transition, but he didn't offer, as I say, a green print on how to get there. A lot of people were disappointed.
Well, you know, I think that the what's happening in the Gulf is very interesting, in the sense that, in addition to being very depressing,
devastating.
In the sense that, you know, he almost had to say, you know, I'm in control, but of course he's not in control. Nobody knows at this point what to do about once you have this kind of disaster, for which there was no real preparation on the part of the oil companies or on the part of government. There's really very little in control that he can do. The one thing that he could have perhaps done, and I've heard Gary Null say this, and I strongly agree with it, is there should be many more ships. Every ship that has the potential for sucking up oil should be there.
Well, now they've called in those other countries who have been offering to help for 2 months. Why now?
I mean, well, there's the lack of leadership. And, you know, to me, that's the scary part, that this administration was willing to allow the spill to get to this point before they began to take action, you know, assuming that some action actually, you know, will happen.
Well, he can't go down and plug the leak. I mean, that people who get angry at him for not being able to stop it, obviously, if anyone could, they would.
Yeah, but, and nuclear explosion is not an option.
Was Bill Clinton actually proposing that they blow it up yesterday? I was at the airport, and I couldn't hear it, but I saw the, you know, translation
going across the screen. Clinton and some others, there was an op-ed article in the Times by a former Navy nuclear expert, you know, but fortunately, I think saner heads will prevail before they set off a nuclear explosion a mile, you know, beneath the surface of the ocean.
Well, is it sane to even be drilling a mile beneath the surface of the ocean?
Well, let's look at that carefully. Right now, the government of Brazil, I think in partnership with Exxon, is drilling a deeper well off the coast of Brazil than the well in the Gulf.
Why do they need oil? I thought they were using ethanol for all their transportation.
They're using ethanol, but their economy is booming, and it's a trade. It's a strong money generator. So, you know, most of the oil now is owned by governments, not by the oil companies. And I had a guest on the program a few weeks ago who was an oil executive, used to be an oil executive, very senior oil executive. And his position was this could have happened to any company. That is, they're all out there now changing the relationship between safety and profit in favor of profit.
As we've learned.
And, you know, the fact that, you know, the Exxon folks and the Shell folks and whatever got up in front of Congress and said, well, we wouldn't have drilled this well this way, that's rats deserting, you know, the sinking ship, but they're rats nonetheless.
I don't think it went very far. I don't think they were very credible.
No, but, you know, but they were desperate.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing. I mean, what else could they say? They could, you know, oh, yeah.
They've been lucky that they haven't had a disaster like this. I mean, when you're drilling that deep. And, you know, they said they had all the fail-safe, you know, and the technological fixes, and now we know there's no such thing. Technology won't save us. If nothing else, I mean, the green lining in this very dark cloud will be that, you know, we can't take the government's word and, you know, certainly corporate oil executives' word that, you know, no problem, we've got it covered. That was probably wishful thinking anyway, but it's painfully evident now as we turn on CNN or any major network any time of the day, and
just go online and you can see, you know, live that oil pouring out of the well.
That video cam, yeah.
But
I mentioned it on CNN because good for them, first of all, for staying on the story. I mean, I hear their ratings are going down. I don't know if it's because Larry King is getting senile as we speak. I just read today's retiring or semi-retiring. But they really, you know, Anderson Cooper, every night, he's been there. And God bless them, really. Yeah. Good for them. We've got to give them a lot of credit for staying on a story that most Americans, frankly, are tiring of because, let's face it, we're, you know, world-class deniers. You know, okay, I can take it for a few days, maybe a few weeks. But this is too awful for my cognitive dissonance, you know, quotient to bear.
Yes,
it's in your face. And I think that's critical that you can see it on mainstream network TV, even if you don't seek it out online.
Right. And there's also, of course, short attention span theater. 60 days or 70 days, however long it's been, is too long, insanely enough. You know,
for our ADD public.
For our public. You know, we want to go on to something else. This is yesterday's news.
Especially, you know, it's summertime, something a little more pleasant. And yet this is despoiling the Gulf Coast beaches, you know, all the way to Florida.
Well, to me, what happens to tourism and the beaches is secondary. What happens to the ecosystem in the Gulf is primary. And that's really what nobody knows very much. You know, the Gulf, that part of the Gulf is one of the few mating areas for bluefin tuna.
And this is mating season.
This is mating season,
right.
And it's now, you know, oil infested. So there are, you know, and an ecosystem is a very complex interaction of many, many different parts.
It's like a spider web. You pull on one end, and the rest can unravel, and most of this has been going on below the surface.
Yeah.
One person who does know about it, Ricky Ott, if you had Dr. Ricky Ott on, I highly recommend her.
No.
She is a fisherman from Alaska. She was there when the Exxon Valdez spilled. She has written two books on the aftermath, both the legal, economic, and mostly the impact, long-term impact on marine life and human health. And there are still major, major problems. She she's been down in the Gulf. They won't let her go home. And she is saying this is going to continue for decades.
Of course,
you know, when it's a mile deep. And so she's a marine toxicologist as well as an activist, educator, and author. And she's highly knowledgeable. And it's frightening to hear her speak about the long-term consequences. And we can all see the short-term immediate consequences on the fishing industry, the tourist industry.
And the Exxon Valdez, as nasty as that was, took place in an ocean area where you didn't have currents that were spreading it far. You have the loop current in the Gulf, and if the winds blow right, this can spread not simply down the west coast of Florida, but around the tip of Florida and up the Atlantic coast. So the level of unknowns here is huge. And
including when they're going to actually get those relief wells drilled and working.
And if they work.
When
there's
and
a when
exactly.
and if.
Exactly. This is far from over. There's no end in sight, really. I mean, they're hoping. They're thinking. They're guessing.
And of course, there's tremendous pressure, and as we saw, legal pressure as well. Not to put a moratorium on drilling in the Gulf, so that this is, hey, we don't know what to do about the spill. This is really terrible. We can't cap the well. We can't, but let's drill some more.
Because it's jobs that will be endangered. You know, it's always the argument. I remember when our old President Bush, was afraid to implement fuel efficiency standards. He said it will be bad for the car companies, it will cost jobs and hurt the economy, wreck the economy, he said. Well, we did nothing as far as improving CAFE standards, and look what happened. Detroit almost died.
Yes.
And so that, first of all, it's a bogus argument. If we are making this giant transition to a clean energy future, as we know we must, and President Obama said, you know, I am launching with this speech the national effort to make that transition, that creates jobs. It has to.
Yes.
If we're smart about it.
Huge job. Huge numbers of jobs. The problem is that Obama front-loaded that speech. So, yes, we are creating this. But then the back end of it, okay, we're creating what exactly? And what does that translate into practically?
He didn't say. And then he ended by saying, let's pray. It was almost like President Bush saying, let's go shopping after 9/11.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, wasn't it the Louisiana legislature that actually passed a resolution that said folks should pray for relief?
And we should, to whatever God you believe in. But guess what, folks? Look where that's gotten us.
That's not going to... Right.
Look where that's gotten us. I happen to know a lot of people are praying for a lot of things. And
What's
you know,
the old phrase?
Can't count on
that. You know, I'm not going to get this one right, but, you know, pray, but keep your musket loaded or something.
Right.
You know, it's...
And, you know, hope for the best, plan for the worst. And yet, let's make the transition, because we could talk about the oil kill, as I call it, because you can spill your coffee and clean it up. This one, obviously, we can't. What do you think is going on? I mean, climate change, it's sort of that same mentality. Well, we can't do anything that might hurt the economy, that might cost jobs. A tax on carbon will be too, you know, punitive. There's no jobs on a dead planet. If we have unstable weather, which, by the way, we're having, the hall that we were in for Al Gore's gathering this weekend was the Wild Horse Saloon. 5 weeks prior to this weekend, it was in 3 feet of water. I mean, the floor had 3 feet of water inside of it. They're still digging out there. Everywhere there are signs for, you know, if you still have flood problems, damage, call this number, TEMA, you know, Tennessee's Emergency Management Agency. That was a 1-in-1,000-year storm in Al Gore's hometown. I thought that was pretty ironic. We are having record damaging tornadoes and hurricanes. And why don't people make those connections? This is certainly what climate change would look like if the predictions are right about unstable weather.
Yeah, this is a very, to me, complicated issue, because there is a difference between climate and weather. You know, weather varies. You have El Nino. You have a lot of forces that impact weather that may or may not be directly associated with climate change. So, you know, you get people saying, gee, we had a cold winter here in the Northeast.
How could this be global warming?
And then you have, you know, you have a major rain
but here's
flooding.
What I just learned
so
about
it's
that.
It's very complicated.
Well, it is.
That relationship is nonlinear.
And even Al Gore says, you know, we cannot attribute accurately any one storm system as devastating as Hurricane Katrina, Wilma, or Rita were, to name a few in 2005. We can't we can't say for sure it's climate change, but we can say that, you know, the scientists say that climate change will bring more of these intense storms, and that's what we're seeing. So it's a trend. You have to look at a trend. And let's see, I think it was 9 out of the last 10 years were the warmest on record. Mm-hmm. The period between January and May, the global and ocean temperatures were the warmest yet. And then, so you say, well, why are we having record snowfall on the East Coast, which you did this past winter? It has to do with more precipitation, and it has to do with weather extremes, as I understand it. So the dry places get drier, therefore we see more worldwide droughts. The wet places get wetter. Right. So it's not so simple, certainly. Yeah. But the point is that climate change is scary because it's climate chaos, really, or it can be. And I don't know for sure, nobody, not even Al Gore knows for sure, but why not err on the side of caution? Why are we playing politics with the planet and with our ecosystem, as you said, that is so intricate and complex that we don't even understand how it all works? Who are we to be messing up this beautiful place?
Well, you know, it's unfortunately, the most direct effects of climate change do not happen in the highly populated, let's say, northern hemisphere of the planet. So we in the United States don't really see what's happening to glaciers. We don't really see the
other than Al Gore's slideshow and
that's a slideshow. That's not everyday life.
We don't see it happening right.
And given the recession, people have immediate and dire concerns about themselves and their families. And it is, we as a species tend, at least as a industrialized species, tend to have a relatively short time horizon. There are some indigenous peoples in Australia, for example, who think routinely in terms of seven generations. That's alien to us.
That's where the paper towel company came from.
Yes, that's alien. Yes, but that's alien to us.
How about second generation?
Yes.
How about your kids and your grandkids?
So, exactly. So that we don't, you know, a lot of what is being discussed in terms of climate change seems to many people to be somewhere in the future, and who knows. Now, the second thing, and by the way, and that's not totally irrational, because the future never happens the way we anticipate it's going to happen. If I would have told you in, let's say, 1980, that by 1988 the Soviet Union would cease to exist, East Europe would cease to exist, and this would happen peacefully, you'd give me a zero probability. That's what happened. So it's very difficult to know what's going to happen in the future.
But we are seeing, just globally, you know, more record, extreme climate conditions.
Yes, but life goes on.
Or it doesn't. I mean, how many people died in Katrina? If that was a globally warmed, infused hurricane.
And many more people have died and will die, let's say, in Bangladesh, where people live on the coast.
That's right.
And they get these massive monsoons, which is the Asian word for hurricanes, and it just devastates poor people living on the coast. And there's a mass human migration toward coasts throughout
environmental
the world.
Refugees are, so, you know, already starting
already
to...
happen.
Yeah. So let me just ask you, just on a personal note, what got you interested in environmental issues? And you said right before we went on that you're feeling pessimistic, and we didn't have time to say if you're a pessimist about any particular thing or maybe the future of life on the planet.
See, now the reporter catches me making what I thought was an off-the-record comment.
Oh, okay.
I'll talk.
Let's make it personal.
I'll talk about it.
Yeah. And there's reason for pessimism. I don't think you're alone there, Steve.
No, the reason... pessimism, in my case, is born from a kind of, I guess, discouraging sense of having been a student in the 60s. I went to college in 1960, got my PhD in 1970, so I was a student for the whole decade. That the kind of change many of us imagined never really eventuated.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to imagine the kind of cross-national agreements that would have to take place in order to really do something effectively about the environment. If the U.S. in isolation does something, or if one country or another, that's not the point. The point is, what can you do internationally? You know, there are some maritime law agreements, but there are precious few international agreements that have teeth. And so I'm pessimistic about the potential. And look what happened
in Copenhagen. Or what didn't happen.
So there is a certain pessimism about the potential for humans to act as humans versus as castes or nationalities or ethnicities.
Consumers. Or
consumers, exactly. So that's one sort. The second is the fact that it takes... We need to act quickly, and because CO2 lasts for a long time, methane not quite, not nearly as long in the atmosphere. But there are, stuff that's
50-year shelf life at least.
At least, and so by the lack of action, we are creating a situation in which it may not be prudent. It may not be possible, rather, to do anything in the near future when things become obviously dire. At that point, it may be the ship has left port.
And yet, what happened to that space between, Al Gore says it, but I've been saying it longer, between denial, problem, what problem, and, too late, just defeat. Despondency, paralysis because it's too late. And that's that window that many of us were trying to wake people up during. The environmentalists certainly, but those of us in media trying to bring attention in mainstream media to these issues that are not fringe, that are not marginal, that, not just for tree huggers. And that's really the frustrating thing. People are too busy living their lives, making a living, raising their kids, understood. It's like problem with problem, easy to ignore, especially in our culture. And all of a sudden you hear people saying, well, it's almost too late, so why bother? Something collapsed in the middle and we skipped that middle section where we should have enough urgency and sense of, doom to get us out of our slumber.
And now we see India and China burning tremendous amounts of coal. China building a coal plant a week. And at that point, and their arguments, although they're not rational at the level of the human species, they're rational at the level of nation versus nation. Their argument is, well, you guys in the West, built your economy on this dirty stuff.
And yet they are starting to get climate change legislation. We can no longer accurately blame China or India for not coming to the table. They are starting to see that it's in their own self-interest to manufacture solar panels and to move to a clean technology future.
No doubt. China is brilliantly clever at this. They've done three things. First, in Copenhagen, they said, nobody's coming into our country, no third, party neutral observers to measure or track our CO2 or greenhouse gas output. Nobody's coming in. Okay, so they put that barrier up. Second thing, they said, which allows them to do things with coal or, whatever. The second thing that they did was to say, if you want us to cut back, you in the West, ante up. The third thing they did was to say, okay, given all of that, we're economically smart and we're a kind of a state capitalist country as opposed to a more democratic capitalist country. So we're going to take the lead in producing PV, solar cells,
and overall,
we're gonna in a sense, from a Chinese standpoint, we have both ends going against the middle. We're gonna do what the hell we want, and we're gonna beat you in green as well.
And I think that's actually the best hope for getting American business, industry, government off their you-know-whats, because we think of ourselves as highly competitive and innovators, and plenty of ingenuity. And so I love that when President Obama in one of his speeches says, China's getting ahead of us. And I don't care how Republican or conservative or anti-environment you are, that should get your patriotic juices flowing. And guess what? It's patriotic to, preserve and protect America's economy. And this is the best way to do it. We have to make this transition from dirty fossil fuel. So that argument is one I really love.
It's hard
for them to argue.
Yes. And there's also even the perhaps not as amenable or acceptable argument that, we can take our ingenuity and entrepreneurship and perhaps even clean up some of these dirty fuels. Now, let me back up. There is no clean coal right now. Clean coal is a myth. And it's a myth that President Obama is partly responsible for encouraging.
Mm-hmm. However, not to mention all those billions being spent on those TV ads that make you feel so good, if only it was true.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, we need all kinds of energy. We need everything, you know. Yeah.
Nice music in the background. Pretty pictures.
But, yeah, well, they're being paid for, so. Mm-hmm. However, there are some entrepreneurs, especially on the West Coast, some extremely wealthy entrepreneurs and investor groups that are funding some innovative ways of taking CO2 out of coal, putting it into concrete.
Sequestration?
Well, not sequestration. Sequestration is typically, you know, trying to bury the stuff. But this is actually making it a component of concrete. Mm. And concrete is a very
CO2 heavy.
Nasty product. And there is some sense that this has potential. Now, whether it can scale, you know, whether it's reasonably cost-effective, who knows? But there are, you know, I don't like to think of God as a... I don't think of God at all. But if I do think of God, because I'm an atheist, but...
Then who are you going to pray to, Steve? This oil stuff.
That's, yes, that is a problem. But I'm a non-theist for your audience.
We'll save that for another show. Yes, I'm already past your 15 minutes you kindly gave me.
But the point that I was going to make is that while God is not a just-in-time techno-fix, as many people hope or pray,
apparently,
there are techno-fixes out there, and I don't rule out really disruptive, innovative technology.
If anything
makes
activism.
Me run counter to my pessimism, it is not the potential for humans to act more sensibly, but the potential for technology to cover up some of our more irrational acts. And
but it can't fix everything.
But I think of the philosopher and logician Karl Popper, who said, you know, we don't know what new technologies they're going to be, because if we knew what they were going to be, we'd already have them. So there is, you know, some hope in what mathematicians might call emergence. Mm-hmm. You know, the stuff that's just going to bubble up. The problem is, of course, this administration isn't putting the right amount of money behind that kind of research. And but that's another topic.
And gazillions of gallons of oil crude continue to bubble up as we speak.
Absolutely.
Steve, thank you so much. That went really fast, and I'm glad I invited you to join me, because it's nice to meet you. Nice to know that you're doing a green program on this great progressive radio network, and really appreciate the time.
Glad
and
to do it.
Hope we can do this again. Maybe I'll be on your show next time.
Yes.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're going to take a quick break here, and when I come back, we'll figure out what we're going to do next. I did an interview with Larry Schweiger while I was down in Nashville at the Climate Project Alliance gathering. And he is, for those of you who don't know, the head of the National Wildlife Federation, also a good buddy of Al Gore's. We talked about stalled climate legislation, as well as a firsthand account of what's going on in the Gulf. He's been down there for the better part of the last 2 months. And I have that interview for you, and maybe a few other items as well. Stay with us. You're listening to Green Front Radio. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and that was Steve Barnett.